So we're in Joshua chapter 3 tonight. Even at a 30,000 foot level, this chapter is just full of amazement and awe in the ways that God provides a way through the Jordan for his people, as we just sung, to enter the promised land. This is a major event in Israel's story, seen all the way back to the promise given to Abraham in chapter 12 of Genesis. To your offspring I will give this land, the Lord said. And now at last, they are moving to its fulfillment. This is also a major stepping stone in salvation history, seen overall as the next stage of God's covenant relationship with Israel swings further into action. Chapters 3 and 4, if you read them properly and devotionally, will certainly show you that they belong together, dealing with the very same events, dealing with the details of the crossing of the Jordan first, and then its memorialization, its remembrance. But if you just do a surface reading, it can appear really repetitive, even confusing at times. And part of that, just as we've seen in other books of the Bible, is intentional by its author. The verb, for instance, to cross, is used 24 times in these two chapters. And the narrator's pattern includes, just like Hollywood movies, flashbacks to earlier events. They seem like they were closed. They seem like they were done. So he will develop the purpose of his writing further by repeating himself. So there are definite patterns that appear on the whole. First, that God takes the initiative by first giving his word and his commandments to his new leader, Joshua. Next, Joshua passes on that word of the Lord to the people, informing them of what God is going to do. Then the writer tells us just how God fulfills what he has been promising. And at the end of each section, there's a linking summary, looking back to God's faithful fulfillment and forward to the next stage of the storyline. So that's the 30,000 foot view. The excitement and the astonishment are sustained over and over again as these details of the actual historical account are carefully described and unpacked. So here in chapter 3, we have the preparations that the people have had to make in order to cross the river, followed by the crossing itself, and the astounding way that God brought it about. Then next week, chapter 4 will then divide into two, with the focus first on the lifting of the memorial stones from the riverbed, being followed second by the memorial itself set up at Gilgal. So tonight, first, preparing for a miracle, verses 1 and 2. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Acacia Grove and came to the Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and lodged there before they crossed over. So it was after 3 days that the officers went through the camp. Behind the matter-of-fact description of verse 1, we're surely meant to sense this measure of excitement and anticipation and suspense that's flowing throughout the camp. They've spent considerable time at Shittim, and now at last they are on the move towards the river. But still there's no word to them about how exactly it's to be crossed. So there's a 3-day pause at verse 2, perhaps to allow the impossibility of what's about to happen to occur in their consciousness from a human point of view, to sink in deeply. Seeming delays frequently have that effect in our lives. The greater purpose is served in refining and even deepening our faith. God does things not by accident. So we must not underestimate the challenge that the river presents to them. A little later in verse 15, there's this parenthetical comment, it's almost in passing, about an aspect of the situation that must have made a huge impact on them visually, where the author says, Now the Jordan overflows all of its banks throughout the time of the harvest. This is not some babbling brook in which to paddle. It is a fast-flowing, swirling flood, probably 12 to 15 feet deep at this season. Fording it or swimming across are out of the question. Rafts are an impossibility for so many people, and engineering is not yet able to excavate an underground passageway as we might do with tractors in the 21st century. Remember, too, this is the whole nation, wives and children, animals and baggage on the move, with no obvious way to cross the swollen river. But they are on the move because God says to move forward. The command was given in verse 2, and as soon as the spies returned, Joshua began to obey. They don't know how it will happen, but they take the next logical step forward in obedience to what God has already said and leave the outcome with God. By the way, is that the way you live? When God assures you that this is what you are to do, to obey, do you find some excuse because you can't see the end? Or do you move ahead in obedience, leaving the outcome to our great God? This is a great lesson on how to live by faith and trust and obedience. Alexander McLaren said, God often opens his hand one finger at a time. That is exactly what is happening here. It's enough to see the next step and to trust God for what we cannot see yet. Indeed, it is the essence of true faith, to trust where we cannot see. For as Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians, we walk by faith and not by sight. The point is powerfully made as well in Isaiah 50, where the suffering servant firmly commits himself to do God's will, trusting in God's constant support and ultimate vindication through all the devastation of pain and grief that is to occur. He says, who among you fears the Lord and obeys the voice of his servant? Let him who walks in darkness and has no light trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God. That's a very helpful reminder that two ingredients can and often coexist together in our lives, walking in darkness and trusting in the Lord's name. Next, we see the instructions. Verse 3, and they commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. The focal point, Joshua is told, is to be the Ark of the Covenant, because this is the symbol of the Lord's presence among his people, here in the role of leader and guide. God's ark is carried, to be sure, by human agents. But the one whose presence it symbolized was the divine one who gives instructions to those who bear it. Israel's response is to follow. Again, this provides us with a continuing principle for our covenant fellowship. It is not our role to second guess what God will do any more than it is to argue about how he possibly could have done it differently. We instead have to follow. Faith gathers up all of our cares and anxieties in the knowledge that God has taken the responsibility for our future and every step ahead of us, and faith leaves it all with God. We must never give up what we do know because of what we don't. Even though we don't know how God's faithfulness and power will be revealed or how he will order our future circumstances, what we do know is that he is our God, committed to us by his unbreakable covenant promise. As Joseph Hart put it in his hymn, how good is the God we adore, our faithful, unchangeable friend. His love is as great as his power, and knows neither measure nor end. Verse 4, yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know by the way of which you must go, for you have not passed this way before. And Joshua said to the people, sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. Then Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. Our attention is drawn to three specific ingredients of their faithful waiting on God. The first is their submission to the specific instructions, which meant looking to the ark and not looking to the water. Within the gold-covered ark, of course, were the tablets of the law, the covenant that God had made with his people, the outward and visible sign of the very terms on which God lived in the midst of Israel. They had to keep their distance for reasons of visibility, but also likely as a reminder that God is holy and that sinners cannot freely come within the range of his presence. The detailed instructions for the setting up of the tabernacle, of course, contain similar prohibitions. Second, they are, in verse 5, to consecrate themselves. In Exodus 19, this involved washing of garments as well as inner submission and concentration and renewed dependence upon God. They're about to have a totally new experience, so they have to be dedicated to God and surrender and follow about a half mile back with their eyes focused on the gold-covered ark. God does his wonders for people who are consecrated unto him. Why all this fuss about preparation for the big event? Just get up and go, I would say. Because it's crucial that Israel recognize that what happens is indeed Yahweh's work. And unless they have a proper insight and expectancy and preparation of their hearts, they could very well see Yahweh's work and yet not understand its true value and significance. I always, not always ask people, but I do ask people from time to time, how much do you prepare spiritually for the worship of God's house on Sunday morning? Tally that up and compare with how much time you spend, oh, I don't know, ironing your clothes, shaving, showering, getting things ready, gathering all the kids together, everything that you do. Tally the difference in time. And you'll see for the average Christian, oh, we give 30 seconds to God in preparation, and we give an hour or 2 hours in preparation for the physical. Do you prepare yourself spiritually for the practice of the public worship of God? If we're not impressed with the grandeur of the living God in our corporate worship, is it because we've not prepared ourselves to see him in mighty ways? Could it be that we even fail to detect the Lord's marvelous works in the routine affairs of our lives simply because, again, we've not prepared ourselves to see it and expect it from our God? And then third, there has to be specific obedience, as verse 6 details. The priests exemplify this. They do exactly what Joshua commands them to do. There's a seriousness and a deliberation about the whole process that's often lacking in our contemporary walk with God. We don't want to wait. Sometimes we don't want to set our lives apart fully to the Lord for his exclusive use. Often we don't want to allow any sort of distance because we imagine we already know the way. We don't need step-by-step guidance. These verses may very well challenge us to some profound reassessment of our daily walk with God, especially in our instant 21st century generation, where we want everything sorted out, everything fixed, everything guaranteed before we ever start. Perhaps that's also why wonderful manifestations of God's glory are comparatively rare among us. This chapter reminds us that we're not writing the agenda, This is the Lord's prerogative. What He requires from us is submissive obedience that desires His glory rather than our own, and is content to fulfill whatever role He is pleased to assign to us. Next, the understanding of God's ways. Verse 7. And the Lord said to Joshua, "This day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. You shall command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, saying, 'When you have come to the edge of the water of the Jordan, you shall stand in the Jordan.'" So Joshua said to the children of Israel, "Come here and hear the words of the Lord your God." And Joshua said, "By this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that He will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Hivites and the Perizzites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is crossing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man from every tribe. And it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, the waters that come down from upstream, and they shall stand as a heap." The past tense at the beginning of verse 7, "he said," probably again places this more detailed instructions before the events that we've just witnessed. The Lord had already said these words to His servant as the basis of verses 3 through 6. Clearly, He revealed more to Joshua than is recorded in these verses, but the emphasis is on His purposes in orchestrating the events in this way. For Joshua, it's the further confirmation of the promises of chapter 1 that the Lord will indeed be with him just as He was with Moses, which carries the assurance to the nation that He is certainly the divinely appointed successor as God begins to exalt Him in their estimation. For Israel, it will be proof that the living God is among you, and following that the assurance that He will without fail drive out before you the Canaanites and the other pagan peoples in the land. He is going to part the waters of the Jordan to enable them to cross into the promised land, just as He crossed or parted the waters of the Red Sea to enable their exodus from Egypt. But there's even more to it than that. He could have brought them over in the dry season, or a different point where the fords would be comparatively shallow. But God chose the most improbable time, the most improbable location, because His deeper purpose was to develop His people's trust in Him. They come into the land physically solely because of the miracle that is about to be described. And of course, this is designed to teach them their essential dependence upon God, the supernatural, divine Lord of the covenant, who will give them the whole land, and they shall conquer it, and it shall be their possession. The priests carrying the ark are to advance to the river's edge, and verse 8 says, "Stand still there." I love that. The people are now told that the Ark of the Lord will be their trailblazer, going over the Jordan ahead of them. They will literally have to follow. They are taking the first steps in the long journey that will lead them to the expulsion of the seven tribal groups named in verse 10. That might seem an even more impossible task, but the God who can get His people across the swollen Jordan can most certainly give them the land. Remember, too, that driving out the nations was an act of righteous judgment by God. God had foretold to Abraham that his descendants would return to the land of Canaan centuries later, when the iniquities of the Amorites had reached their completion. So the Israelites are going to be the instrument by which the land is judged and purged of the gross immorality and occult practices that characterized Canaanite culture. It's because the land belongs to God, and because He has purposes of unimaginable grace for Abraham's seed and all the families of the earth that will be blessed, that therefore this conquest has now arrived. He is in reality, as well as the words, the Lord of all the earth. Then in verse 13, the nature of the forthcoming miracle, a manifestation of supernatural creative power, is described. As soon as the priest's feet touch the river's side, the water shall be cut off from flowing, God says. For the first time, we the readers are given a glimpse of what God is about to do, and it is awesome. By definition, all miracles are extraordinary, but this is so beyond human ability or even comprehension that it can have no explanation besides God's power. The fact that it's announced ahead of time, beforehand, is further confirmation of its divine origin. There's nothing to indicate coincidence or natural causes in human terms, as it is impossible. As is so often, John Calvin's comments are an enormous help to us. He writes here, "The title Lord of all the earth here, applied to God, is not insignificant, but extols His powers above all the elements of nature. In order that the Israelites, considering how seas and rivers are subject to His dominion, might have no doubt that the waters, though naturally liquid, would become stable in obedience to Yahweh's word. Yahweh delights to show His might in the face of utter helplessness, apparently so that we cannot help seeing that we contribute nothing to our deliverance. Now experiencing the impossible," verse 14, "so it was, when the people set out from their camp to cross over the Jordan, when the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as those who bore the Ark came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests who bore the Ark dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest, that the waters which came down from upstream stood still and rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zaratan. So the waters that went down into the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people crossed over opposite Jericho. Then the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel crossed over on dry ground until all the people had crossed completely over the Jordan." We should certainly not underestimate the courage and the faith of the priests to obey as they advanced towards the river carrying the ark. The banks had been submerged by the overflowing river. They could so easily, on human terms, lose their footing, stumble into a hole, or be swept away by the current. But the greater the obstacle that faith encounters, the greater is the victory and assurance that comes from continuing to act in trust and obedience to God. Verses 14 and 15 record the facts, so there can be no doubt as to what actually took place. Pressing on in faith and obedience, the priests reached the river. Nothing has changed. The river is still in full flood. But as soon as they took the next step of obedience and put their feet in the stream, the promised miracle happened, exactly as predicted. And the ark went into the river and stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan. So the whole nation passed over safely as the waters remained heaped up. Again, Calvin says, "There cannot be a doubt that this wonderful sight must have been received with feelings of fear, leading the Israelites more directly to acknowledge that they were saved in the midst of death. For what was it that collected that heap but a grave in which the whole multitude would have surely been buried had the waters resumed their naturally liquid state?" Adam, the city beside Zaratan, is thought to be about 20 miles upstream from Jericho, which would have left a very wide crossing for the whole nation to utilize. Even so, it must have taken several hours at least to make this crossing. The end of the chapter focuses attention on the centrality of the ark in the whole supernatural event. While the ark is in the river and the priests stand firmly on dry ground, the nation is safe, and so they swarm across. Don't you think those spies from Jericho, doubtless hidden up in the hills, would have rushed home that day to talk about seeing all those people crossing the impossible barrier on the dry riverbed? God does wonders for his people, and what he promises by his word, he accomplishes by his power. And so his predictions become his actions. There could not be a more magnificent, God-glorifying beginning of the conquest of the land. And what does it mean to us? Well, I remember a Southern gospel song that said, "Got any rivers you think are uncrossable? Got any mountains you can't tunnel through? God specializes in things thought impossible. He does the things others cannot do." Yes, that is our God. He can and does perform miracles. But I want to add, do not presume that your particular set of difficulties will melt away from divine intervention. The fact that God can do the impossible does not mean that he always will. This is no unconditional promise in this passage that will be valid for all of God's people in all the varied challenges and complexities and circumstances of life in this world. After all, after the Israelites crossed the Jordan, they generally had to use everyday, normal human methods to carry out their daily lives. That particular miracle never occurs again. That's why I often say, they call it a miracle. Miracles are rare in the Bible, much less in our lives. So often we make the mistake. We read the Bible, the Old Testament narratives, the Gospels, we see the miracles Jesus performed. We read the book of Acts and we see the miracles there. But we read the Bible badly and then suffer huge disappointment, which if repeated, can even begin to spell shipwreck for our faith. We rush to interpret the story by looking for some similarity or coincidence with our present circumstance. Friend, life will always present difficulty. And sometimes these seemingly immovable and impossible things, like a river in full flood barring our way, prevent fulfillment and enjoyment because we tell ourselves, God must act in this way in my life. You know what happens? We ourselves become the children of Israel in our interpretation of the story, and we put ourselves in their shoes, perhaps sandals, on the brink of the river, claiming that God will miraculously intervene to remove our impossible barriers. But somehow, then he doesn't. So we ask why. We think perhaps I'm not consecrated enough. Or maybe my record of obedience and, you know, fulfillment to God's purposes is not impressive enough to him. Perhaps he isn't even interested in my life at all. Or perhaps the promises have no real benefit. Maybe I've been lied to all along. Maybe God just doesn't exist. You can see the perilous downward spiral that can result from this misunderstanding. All because we tried to draw a direct line from this unique salvation history event for Israel, or for the first century disciples, or the early New Testament church, to our day and our individual life experience. Friend, that's the wrong line to draw. The question instead we should be asking, first and foremost, in the Old Testament narratives like this, is what is God teaching about God here? That's the strong and direct line we can make from the biblical text to our own lives, because whatever God reveals about himself in the narrative remains true for us today. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is the eternal and unchanging God.
So we are to allow the story to instruct us about God before we rush out to put ourselves in the picture. The Bible, friend, is God's book about God before it is God's book about you. In their excellent introduction to biblical interpretation, Fee and Stewart, in the book called How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth, say no Bible narrative was written specifically about you. You can always learn a great deal from these narratives, but you can never assume that God expects you to do the exact same things that the Bible characters did, or have the same things happen to you that happened to them. And I would just say, exactly. It is not, therefore, a measure of our faith as to whether or not we can convince ourselves that God will part the waters for us of our so-called Jordan by some divine intervention. That might not be His best purposes for you at all. New Testament promises, clearly intended for God's people at all times, can be claimed in faithful prayer, expecting that the Lord will be faithful always to His word. But we are not at liberty to construct promises of miraculous intervention for ourselves from a narrative like Joshua 3. What then does it have to say to us? The answer is a very great deal. It teaches us that this God, our God, the Lord of heaven and earth, of time and eternity, still lives and reigns. He works all things in the history of planet Earth according to the purposes of His will. And all things include every circumstance of your individual life. Romans 8:28 is a precious promise used to make that point. We know that all things work together for good for those who love God and are the called according to His purpose. But sometimes we fail to set that verse in its immediate context by reading on to the next verse in verse 29 to see what His purpose actually is. We tend to assume it must be my well-being. It must be my healing. It must be my happiness as His dearly loved child. But the next verse doesn't say any of that. It shows us that it is richer and deeper than that. For those whom He foreknew, He also predestined what? To be conformed to the image of His Son. Friend, His purpose in your life is to restore the defaced image of God in each of us, His redeemed human creatures, to make us more and more in the image of His Son, Christ Jesus. That is how we are to face our crises. That is how we are to face our adversaries, to see them as the transformation process that God knows we need to become increasingly dependent upon Him, to put us on our back so we look up only to Him, to produce the fruit in our lives that magnifies Him. And seeing our lives from that perspective, Joshua 3 is actually immensely glorifying and strengthening, both in our understanding of God's purpose and our confidence in His total wisdom and complete ability to bring us to a glorious and successful place in His kingdom. That will also change our perspective on all the world around us in our own moment in time in this year. So as we see our lives caught up in something much greater than our immediate needs, our immediate circumstances, no. We are part of the universal kaleidoscope of the purposes of the Lord of the universe as He carries out His plans through which His eternal kingdom will be both revealed and established. And He is the God of the impossible, as this chapter reveals. The anti-God forces, not only in America, but around this world, seem to be in full flood in our time and in our place. But it is not outside God's control. The same is true of the overwhelming problems and pressures that may impact any local congregation of God's people, or indeed any individual believer. He still makes a way for those who consecrate themselves to Him, for those who trust and obey Him. Perhaps our problem is that we're basically looking for wood to build a raft, or we're beginning to build a plan for our bridge building or our tunnel digging, but we've lost sight of the God who does amazing things all by himself, and we're too impatient to wait for his will and his way. But the ark, the symbol of God's mercy and faithfulness, still leads us in the person of his darling Son, the Lord Jesus, who has promised never to leave us or forsake us. We're to follow him, Hebrews 12 says, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. For Israel, this is just the first step into the land, the beginning of a very long journey to possess what God is in the process of giving them. There will be many more challenges, not the least of which is Jericho, threatening to bar their progress and frustrate God's purposes. But nothing can stop the God who made and governs the whole created order, and for whom the waters rise and stand by themselves in a heap. And that God is with us, his people, throughout our lives and on throughout eternity. We must trust him. And because we trust him, we must obey him.